Iran-backed militias carry out multiple attacks on U.S. forces in Syria, killing one American and wounding others, as the U.S. responds with a retaliatory strike of its own. We'll hear from a University of Oklahoma analyst who sees the conflict getting worse.
This is an inevitable clash. Iran is going to turn up the pressure on the American occupation in order to try to drive them out.
Plus, another expert with the Washington Institute for Near East Policy tells us why the U.S. will not want to be bullied into leaving Syria. And later in the program, the last woman to serve as an Iranian minister before the 1979 Islamic Revolution tells us how the memory of women's rights from that era inspires the young female protesters of today.
It very easily passes on to the next generation, especially in a country which had really moved forward so much.
From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Iran. Good morning, I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. U.S. officials say Iran-backed militias in Syria used an Iranian drone to hit an American military base in Syria's northeast last Thursday, killing a U.S. civilian contractor and wounding six other Americans. They say U.S. fighter jets retaliated later that day by hitting Syrian sites linked to Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. President Joe Biden also had this message for Iran as he visited Canada last Friday.
To make no mistake, the United States does not emphasize seek conflict with Iran, but be prepared for us to act forcefully, protect our people. That's exactly what happened last night. We're going to continue to keep up our efforts to counter terrorist threats in the region in partnerships with Canada and other members of the coalition to defeat ISIS.
Biden was referring to the main mission of the 900 U.S. troops in Syria, preventing a resurgence of the Islamic State terrorist group known as ISIS, whose caliphate the U.S. and its allies destroyed in 2019. Some Republicans in Congress say the U.S. has not retaliated strongly enough for dozens of Iranian-backed militia attacks on U.S. forces in Syria and Iraq under Biden. Those attacks include another one last Friday. At a U.S. Senate hearing on Tuesday, Republican Senator Tom Cotton questioned Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin about it.
And after we retaliated, Iran attacked us again, injuring another American, didn't it?
They did.
And have we retaliated for that attack on Friday?
We have not yet, Senator.
So what kind of signal do we think this sends to Iran when they can attack us 83 times since Joe Biden has become president and we only respond 4?
For more on this, I spoke on the phone to Joshua Landis, professor of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I asked him what methods Iran uses to arm its Syrian proxies.
Normally, it sends them overland or by plane. And that would be driving them from Iran through Iraq to Syria. They can send them by plane also to the airports. They can also ship them. But this is a difficult task because Israel is policing both the skies and the sea like a hawk, combined with the United States. They help each other with intelligence and so forth. So there have been a number of Iranian ships that have been scuttled or taken with arms on them. And also, Israel has been attacking almost several times, 2 times a week, 1 time a week for the last several years, hitting airports and other places, convoys that are driving in. So there's an attempt by the coalition forces and by Israel to pick off any kind of arms supplies to Syria that come from Iran or from Russia, but it's harder to do that with Russians.
The U.S. has said in recent days that there have been almost 80 attacks on U.S. forces in Syria since the beginning of 2021, and they seem to follow a kind of a pattern where the U.S. will launch retaliatory operations that go against, you know, certain militant group targets. What do you think is the point of the Iranian-backed forces in that area striking at the U.S. from time to time when the U.S. has not actually left, which seems to be their goal? And the U.S. hits back, you know, pretty hard, although in a limited way.
Well, there are two goals. One is Iran is retaliating for Israeli strikes, which have been frequent. And Israel is trying to bomb all of Iranian emplacements, Hezbollah emplacements, any weapon system that gets into Syria that could possibly hurt Israel in the future. So these troops are getting killed by Israel. Iran cannot attack Israel directly, so it attacks these American bases because America and Israel are working closely hand in glove on this operation. So in some ways, it's retaliation. In the other, Iran wants and Syria want the Americans not to be occupying Syria. They want the American troops out because 30% of Syrian territory is under American control and the control of its proxy military, the YPG, or the Syrian Democratic Forces, as they're called. And America trains, funds, and pays for these troops. Now, in part, it's paying for them because America captured most of Syria's oil wells. And that's where the troops were that were hit are sitting next to these oil wells, protecting them and making sure that they work, because those oil wells are paying for this militia and for the government of northeast Syria, the autonomous government, which is run largely by Kurds. And Syria wants that territory back. That money is fundamental to the Syrian government and paid much of the government budget before the war. So having those oil wells is key to the economy of Syria and the government's ability to function. And that's part of the reason why America took them in the beginning, because it wanted to put pressure on the Syrian government. So this is an inevitable clash. Iran is going to turn up the pressure on the American occupation in order to try to drive them out so it can get back its territory, its land, and its sovereignty. And that's just going to go on endlessly.
Do you think that Syria and Iran believe they realistically can just push the U.S. out, that they have the capability to actually do that?
Oh, yes. You know, what is America achieving by being there? Nothing, really. Part of the reason it is degrading ISIS, but Assad's army could also take on ISIS, particularly if it had these oil wells and the money to do it. It did it before. There was no ISIS in Syria before the civil war. And now Assad is consolidating his power once again. So it's not clear what America's mission is there. In part, its mission is to frustrate Iran and to make Syria poor so that its backers, Russia and Iran, Syria will be a quagmire for those two powers. So it's really a game of spoiling. In some ways, America there is in order to keep Syria poor. And Syrian government doesn't want to be poor, and the Syrian people don't want to be poor. So they're going to attack this American occupation. And, you know, we saw President Trump try to withdraw. His men said, no, you can't do that. We're supporting these Kurdish militias, and we can't dump them. We also have to be anti-Iran and protect Israel. Now, this mission is still the mission. But as we've seen recently, Republican congressmen have put forward bills saying, what are we doing in Syria? We don't have a realizable mission anymore. We should bring our troops home before they get killed and wounded. So Iran wants to kill and wound these Americans so that they'll come home. Now, Biden is not going to do this. He has promised that he will stay there. But that's because largely, he withdrew from Afghanistan, and he let down the Afghan people who had become totally dependent on America over the last 20 years with a thump, and the Taliban retook it, and he got a bloody eye for doing that. And he's not going to do that over again with the Kurds of Syria. He's going to kick the can down the road to the next administration in the same way that, you know, four presidents did it on Afghanistan. Everybody knew we were losing. But nobody wanted to take responsibility for it because it was going to be a defeat. And that's the same thing that's going to happen in Syria. We do not have a real reason to be in Syria anymore. And so somebody is going to pull us out, and it's just a matter of when.
Well, Joshua Landis, director for the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma, speaking to us from Norman, Oklahoma. Nice of you to join us on Flashpoint Iran this week.
Well, it was a pleasure being with you.
Iran condemned the U.S. retaliatory strike in Syria and called the U.S. troop presence there illegal. That kind of rhetoric is unlikely to drive out the U.S., according to Matthew Levitt of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. In a Monday phone call, I asked him what the U.S. sees as its main rationale for staying in Syria.
The U.S. presence in northeast Syria is related to the effort to combat the Islamic State, Daesh. It remains a critically important station. The Islamic State is down but not out. The caliphate, its territorial control, is not what it once was, of course. But just today, there are reports of ISIS kidnapping and murdering people in different parts of Syria. And the U.S. presence there has proven to be incredibly important. Ultimately, when the Iranians are striking U.S. forces in Syria, what they're doing is undermining efforts to combat the Islamic State. Now, the fact that the U.S. presence is there is a frustration to the Iranians because it sits on territory that interrupts Iran's preferred territorial contiguity between Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon. And it sits on key trade routes across which they'd like to be able to do what they'd like, including shipping significantly capable and long-range precision-guided missiles to Hezbollah. That's not the purpose of the mission, but it's a nice secondary effect of the garrison's purpose, which is to counter ISIS, and that's what it's doing.
Well, I was speaking a little earlier to Joshua Landis of the University of Oklahoma on this subject, and he said he believes the U.S. doesn't have any good reasons to stay in Syria, where it's seen as an occupying force that Syria and its ally Iran will keep trying to kick out of the country. What's your view?
So long as the Islamic State remains credible, a credible threat locally and potentially beyond, it'll be important for the West, led in this case by the United States, to be at the forefront of this battle. We cannot rely on the Assad regime, which played a very direct and prominent role in building up the capabilities of the Islamic State, releasing Islamic prisoners, jihadists from prison who became Islamic State leaders, choosing to fight everyone but the Islamic State on the battlefield, knowingly doing business with the Islamic State in oil, wheat, and other things. And you certainly can't bank on the Iranians in this regard either. To say that the U.S. is occupying Syria is just folly. The United States presence is tiny. Syria is a broken state. And with what capabilities it has chosen to deploy those against its fellow Syrians as opposed to the international terrorist group that's taken root in its territory. So I don't think that the United States is going to be bullied out of this tiny presence. The Assad regime doesn't have a whole lot of credibility right now, certainly doesn't control all of the country. And there is international consensus on the need to, A, deal with the Islamic State, and B, I think separately, to press for reform in Syria of the type that Syrian citizens were originally protesting for when the Assad regime started barrel bombing them and using chemical weapons against them, turning this into a civil war.
What do you see as the end game for the U.S. military presence in Syria?
It's unclear what the end game is, and I think that sometimes people tend to have too much of a World War II, Cold War mentality of victory and defeat, when sometimes a presence like this is all about being there as long as is necessary to hold back things from getting worse. If there's someone else who can come in behind U.S. forces and keep the threat from the Islamic State resurgence at bay, maybe that'll provide an opportunity for these troops to come home. Until that point, U.S., and it's not just U.S., but other Western troops will need to be there to be able to make sure that the Islamic State doesn't rise again. U.N. reports, it's not just U.S. government reports, document time and again the precarious situation in the region. The Islamic State is not top of the fold of your daily newspaper anymore, but it still is a threat, especially in the region. And so right now, I think the policy is the United States will remain there as long as is necessary in a small, affordable footprint of a kind that is the exact opposite than what we saw in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of the type, by the way, that the U.S. has successfully deployed for many years in other places, whether it's the Korean Peninsula or Germany, and to keep threats at bay.
Well, Dr. Matthew Levitt, director of the counterterrorism program at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, joining us on the line from DC. Great to have your perspective on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Michael Lippin. The fight for women's rights in Iran has been one focus of recent protests against the nation's Islamist rulers. But that fight goes back much further than last September when those protests began. One activist who was involved in the struggle in the years before Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is Mahnaz Afkhami. She served as a women's affairs minister under Iran's then-monarch Mohammad Reza Shah and now heads an international advocacy group called Women's Learning Partnership. I met Afkhami at a Washington event last Wednesday to get her perspective on the status of women under the Shah.
Well, it was completely a different kind of an approach because Iran in the 1970s, when I worked there, I both headed the National Women's Organization, which had 349 branches and on more than 100 centers for skills building, for legal work, for childcare, and all of that. In effect, we had something like a million people come to the organization during 1 year, the last year, for instance. The reason was because the women themselves were really excited, enthusiastic, and ready to participate, you know. But, of course, the government that I worked with was not by any means a feminist government. Feminism was an unusual term at that time for women as well as men. And so what it was that since the goals of the government were development and modernity, that's why we could work within that context, because it was always possible to say to the Ministry of Education when I was in the cabinet, for instance, that, okay, if you're talking about bringing up the literacy rate, if you want to get skilled workers, if you want to have enough people in medicine, in science, in teaching or whatever, half of the population is there. You got to engage that half of the population. So they could buy in.
Now it's 44 years later, and I've often wondered how much memory of the development that went on pre-revolution exists still today, because you have several new generations that have come. Many of the young women protesting in the last few months, obviously were not around that long ago. But how much do they know about, the younger generation today in Iran, know about the work that you all did, you know, before 1979?
To tell you the truth, after the revolution, with all the propaganda that was going on, the negative propaganda that was going on, and all that one heard, I was myself wondering, I mean, was it really what we thought? Was it really that impactful? And then more and more, as time passed, I saw how important it is that once consciousness is raised, once people learn their rights, and once they learn to be mobilized and mobilized others, it can't be taken away.
And why not?
Because you can't get thoughts and ideas and aspirations out of people's heads. It may have been that that generation was not born yet, but the mothers and the grandmothers were there. And this culture change had happened. And this culture change would pass from one to the other.
How does that happen? The passing along of memory from a grandmother to the mother to the daughter. Can you give an example to illustrate that?
Mothers are the ones that train the children. They tell them the values, you know. What mothers are the ones that that tell the daughter, for instance, that you must learn, you must know, you must be literate, you must have a job, you must have a skill. You know, it very easily passes on to the next generation, especially in a country which had really moved forward so much. You know, if you look at our films, if you look at our poetry, if you look at our music, if you look at the level of industrialization, we were exporting to other countries from cars to washing machines to everything else. And so in every aspect, you know, we were one of the most advanced developing countries. And the whole culture of the country politically, we were friends with everybody. We were friends with the Marxist countries. We were friends with the capitalist countries. We were friends with Europeans, with Arabs, with everybody.
Even with Israel, actually.
Even with Israel, especially with Israel. I remember when I was at the United Nations, you know, one of our closest friends was Israel. And we weren't supposed to, you know, really go and hug the Israeli ambassador or show too much friendship. But, you know, we were told to be a little bit careful. But we were, in effect, counted on Israel for a lot of support, you know.
Well, today, women who have inherited all these ideas, inspirations from their mothers and grandmothers, they're leading the protests. And one thing you mentioned at the event here at the George Washington University, which you spoke at, is how the women who are leading these protests have worked with men to achieve greater impact. How does that process work?
Well, to tell you the truth, this process of our organization, the two international organizations that I founded, basically, have worked with Iranians all along. And we have tried and we have actually succeeded in bringing the heads of organizations established in Iran, especially those established in times when it was a little bit more possible to have give and take with the Iranian situation, like during Khatami, for instance. So we were working with these young women, and we helped pass on some of what we were learning across the world from the global movement that we were one of the leaders of.
And they took that back with them to Iran?
They took that back with them, even just the simple things like capacity, organizational capacity building, how to build a civil society where it's more participatory, more dialogue-based, more sharing of knowledge, you know.
And how do men play a role in this?
The men are very helpful. It's extremely helpful. You know, we are mostly located as a Women's Learning Partnership, WLP. We are working mostly in the Global South. And Global South, I mean big and successful countries like China or Thailand or Malaysia, all the way to Africa and Central Asia. And what we have learned from the work that we do is that the Global South should have ways of passing on understanding of their cultural context to some more advanced, so to speak, countries such as the United States. But unfortunately, not all countries are ready to absorb what is learned in the Global South. And this is one of the unfortunate pieces, because right now, for instance, the United States is way behind where we were 40 years ago in terms of women's rights, in terms of having 7 months maternity leave, of half-time work for full-time benefits, childcare on the premises of the workplace, so that women can be leaders. You can't be leaders if you don't have the help and if you don't have the support of the community, of the society.
Of men
as well. Of men. That's it. The whole thing is men, you know, to be able to connect with them and to bring them in and for men to understand that all of this is necessary, that if you're going to have your goals, what you need is to have women helping you. And so what we did actually was with the 1 million signatures, with the Green Movement, and with all of the other developments that were happening, we brought the best of what we saw in everywhere we worked to our colleagues in Iran and also learned from them, learned a lot from them, just as now we're learning from them because they're doing something entirely beyond what we had imagined.
Manaz Afkhami, former Minister for Women's Affairs in Iran and President of the Women's Learning Partnership, speaking to us here at the George Washington University. Thanks so much for being on Flashpoint Iran.
Thank you.
That's all for this week's show. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and please join me again next week for another Flashpoint Iran.